Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good and bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And I'm pretty sure the crazy one can also have a little bit of bad flavor thrown in there, too. So, Jim, covering a lot of bases in the course of three martinis. Let's start with the only one that we know is distinctively in one category, and that's the good martini. This is courtesy of the Washington Times. A strict D.C. gun law that prevents most firearms owners from carrying concealed handguns in public in the nation's capital is unconstitutional, a federal appeals court panel ruled Tuesday, saying the city government cannot demand citizens prove a quote-unquote good reason before being issued permits. In a 2-1 decision, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit ordered lower courts to issue permanent injunctions blocking enforcement of the law. The ruling is the latest blow to the district's efforts to curtail gun possession and use. The Supreme Court struck down the city's near-total ban on firearms possession in 2008, and a federal court blocked an effort to ban the carrying of firearms in public in 2014. The D.C. Council responded to that ruling with its good reason regulations, which require residents to prove they have a good reason to fear injury or another proper reason, such as a job that requires carrying large amounts of cash or valuables in order to get a concealed carry permit. Under the city's law, living in a high-crime neighborhood was not reason enough to justify approval of a concealed carry permit. So the judge in this case, who's writing for the majority, Thomas B. Griffith, says, quote, "At the Second Amendment's core lies the right of responsible citizens to carry firearms for personal self-defense beyond the home, subject to long-standing restrictions. These traditional limits include, for instance, licensing requirements, but not bans on carrying in urban areas like D.C., or bans on carrying absent a special need for self-defense." So, Jim, turns out the Second Amendment doesn't have an invisible clause there that makes you prove you have a darn good reason for carrying a gun. Turns out you just have that right.
To summarize this succinctly, it basically is the ruling is that there is no good reason to pass a law requiring you to have a good reason to own a gun. In fact, you might as well just call it a bad reason law. Now, I think what strikes me is that this is now, I believe somebody had saw yesterday, it was the sixth decision at various court levels, basically saying to the District of Columbia, no, you can't ban guns this way. And going back to the Heller decision, a law and a restriction on handguns that I lived on for a long time when I was living in D.C., and then they kept changing it. And they kept basically saying, well, we're not totally banning guns. If you apply for a permit on alternating Tuesdays when the moon is right, and if we sacrifice the entrails, and if the oracle says, yes, you may have a gun, then you may have a gun. And the courts keep saying, no, that's not what the Second Amendment says. The impetus is on you, the government, to show good reason to restrict someone, not on the citizen to say, no, here's why I need to have one. It's not mother may I. It doesn't work that way for any of our other constitutional rights. And there's really no reason it should work that way for this one. Now, we'd like to think that at this point, the city council would recognize, okay, we can't ban guns. We have to stop trying to ban guns. We have to stop trying to do these backdoor methods to make it almost impossible to own a gun. As I understand it, it's almost impossible to set up a shooting range in D.C. At one point, they were going to try to make it almost impossible to transport your gun so you could have the gun. You simply just couldn't get it from one place to another. And if you did so, you were committing a crime. It is kind of infuriating the way the District of Columbia applies these sorts of laws because, hey, I don't know if you've noticed, fellas, there's some crime in Washington, D.C. there's actual murders, actual drug trade, actual genuine serious crime that needs to be dealt with rather than hassling law-abiding gun owners. But that's where things stand. It's always nice to see the District of Columbia gun laws get slapped down in court. The only nagging feeling about this is probably this is not the last court. They're probably just going to go back and then say they'll get rid of the good reason law and come back with a okay reason law or something like that. And just, we'll back to square one again.
Oh, city of D.C. Just take no for an answer and move on here. Let people have their rights. And I believe once the Heller decision came down from the Supreme Court, and while it was a bureaucratic mess to get your gun, enough people did it that the crime rates did go down. I'm sure there's some debate as to all what is responsible for that, but certainly Second Amendment advocates would argue that having more guns in the hands of citizens puts a few more questions in the minds of criminals, and that was a key factor in some of the crime rates going down. But let's move on to the good/bad martini now. And Jim, the good martini is that John McCain, despite his cancer diagnosis, back in Washington yesterday, kind of a dramatic moment because they were waiting on him to show up from the airport to cast the decisive vote on whether or not this motion to proceed would pass to begin debate on the larger health care bill. It's essentially a motion to proceed on debate on the House bill, which nobody thinks is going to end up being passed in its exact form. So after McCain voted to tie it up at 50-50 and Mike Pence broke the tie, McCain went on the floor to point out that, yeah, I'm not actually going to vote for this bill.
I voted for the motion to proceed to allow debate to continue and amendments to be offered. I will not vote for this bill as it is today. It's a shell of a bill right now. We all know that. I have changes urged by my state's governor that will have to be included to earn my support for final passage of any bill. I know many of you will have to see the bill change substantially for you to support it.
So far, he doesn't like the process at all.
We tried to do this by coming up with a proposal behind closed doors in consultation with the administration, then springing it on skeptical members, trying to convince them that it's better than nothing.
I think some conservatives would certainly agree with that frustration. Here's what he says about Obamacare in general.
Our health care insurance system is a mess. We all know it. Those who support Obamacare and those who oppose it. Something has to be done. We Republicans have looked for a way to end it and replace it with something else without paying a terrible political price. We haven't found it yet, and I'm not sure we will. All we've managed to do is make more popular a policy that wasn't very popular when we started trying to get rid of it.
Well, that's encouraging, Senator McCain. Let's move on to the bigger picture items here in our last two clips. First of all, he talks about how our system, as gummed up as it is still way better than just about everybody else, if not everybody else.
Considering the injustice and cruelties inflicted by autocratic governments and how corruptible human nature can be, the problem solving our system does make possible the fitful progress it produces and the liberty and justice it preserves is a magnificent achievement.
So he extols the founding fathers. He extols their wisdom. One of those pieces of wisdom was free speech, and in some cases he's not too fond of that. Here's the last clip we're going to use of him.
I hope we can again rely on humility, on our need to cooperate, on our dependence on each other, to learn how to trust each other again, and by so doing better, serve the people who elected us. Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them. They don't want anything done for the public good. Our incapacity is their livelihood.
Jim, thankfully he's not talking about us because we're clearly not bombastic. I'll let other folks decide who he is talking about. What do you make of his immediate pessimism on getting anything done? And on his decision to pretty much trash everyone who's part of this debate and in the Senate and outside of the Senate.
Yeah, we're only bombastic when it comes to Die Hard, Greg. So on the one hand, first, indisputably, it's really great to see John McCain back. Obviously, he'll be taking some time off to deal with his treatment for his cancer diagnosis. But it is better to have him there than not have him there. If for no other reason, then it makes it easier to have the bills, to vote on bills like the motion to proceed to get the debate rolling and move the repeal and replacement of Obamacare one step closer. There's a lot of legitimate criticism that he makes in his assessment of the problems of the process. It is a painful truth indeed that for Republicans, Obamacare's approval has slowly been creeping up since this debate began. I don't know whether people simply are afraid of the unknown and they're afraid that the replacement will give them a worse deal than what they're getting under Obamacare. One of the things really kind of irritating about this is he kind of echoed something that Peggy Noonan had written about in her column this weekend, and she was kind enough to quote me as a skeptic of finding a happy kumbaya bipartisan solution. But McCain kind of continues his emphasis there, and he said, well, we need to work together, we need to come together for these bipartisan common sense ideas. And Greg, I'm all for it. I just want to hear what those bipartisan common sense ideas are, because if you look at what the Democrats want to do, they want to some say the real issue is that we're just not enforcing the individual mandate enough, and that if you had strict enforcement of it, everybody who's currently slacking on either paying the tax penalty or buying health insurance would do so. It would restore the markets, the insurers would be better, and that would bring down premiums. I'm rather doubtful of that scenario, but because I think plenty of people are obeying the mandate, and the insurance companies are still in trouble.
But that's one solution the Democrats like. Obviously, Republicans will not. Another one is they want to create a basically a payment pool for insurers who take on particularly high risk or high cost patients. Now you go, oh, okay, yeah, shore up the insurers so they can cover more people. This sounds an awful lot like the bailout of the insurance companies right. that everybody kept demonizing. Let's take more taxpayer money and give it to the insurers. The whole point of this was to not have to give them more money. And then the third one is various. No, we got to give more subsidies to the people who are having trouble paying for their insurance. Now, I'm sure a lot of people would like that, but it's not a particularly conservative idea. It doesn't represent anything resembling entitlement reform. It's simply taking more money from one group of taxpayers and dispersing it to others. Conservatives aren't going to like any of those mandates, expansions, subsidies, all that kind of stuff. So what are these moderate ideas that what do conservatives get out of this? If you want to reduce the role of government in this entire process, if you want a smaller role for government in this whole thing, what do we get out of this? And at this point, I don't see anything that the Democrats are offering, to say nothing of the fact that even, you know, the Heidi Heitkamps of the world and Joe Manchin's pretty resolutely, adamantly opposed to making any significant changes to Medicaid as is. And that was the part of the bill that conservatives liked, that it represented a significant entitlement reform, that all of a sudden it would not just be, yeah, for however many people, we're just going to keep sending you money, states. Now we're going to give you a certain amount, state, and you have to get to, you know, decide how to best allocate that. It really is kind of very deeply frustrating to figure out, everybody's going, okay, let's get a bipartisan moderate idea. Okay, what does bipartisan moderate healthcare reform look like? And of course, McCain did not spell that out very much. I think everyone wants these moderate ideas to exist, but I don't think they really do. And I think we would get to the resolution a lot quicker if everyone would kind of recognize that Republicans and Democrats have fundamentally different ideas about how to deal with the problems in the healthcare system. So anyway, I'll step down off my soapbox, but that was the bad aftertaste, an otherwise good martini, of seeing McCain back on the Senate floor.
Let's move on to the crazy martini now. And Jim, you'd think this would get more coverage in the media. So far, not a lot, but enough of it to give us the background to this story. First, the Daily Caller. This comes from a couple days ago. FBI agents seized smashed computer hard drives from the home of Florida Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz's Information Technology Administrator, according to two sources with knowledge of the investigation. Pakistani-born Imran Awan, longtime right-hand IT aide to the former Democratic National Committee chairwoman, has since desperately tried to get the hard drives back. An individual whom FBI investigators interviewed in the case told the Daily Caller News Foundation's investigative group. An additional source in Congress with direct knowledge of the case, speaking on condition of anonymity because of the sensitivity of the probe, confirmed that the FBI has joined what was previously described as a Capitol Police criminal probe into serious, potentially illegal violations on the House IT network by Imran and three of his relatives, who had access to the emails and files of more than two dozen House Democrats who employed them on a part-time basis. That's part one of the crazy martini. This one's more recent. Politico. Imran Awan, a House staffer at the center of a criminal investigation potentially impacting dozens of Democratic lawmakers, has been arrested on bank fraud and is prevented from leaving the country while the charges are pending. Why? Oh, he was arrested at Dulles Airport on Monday evening before boarding a flight to Lahore, Pakistan. His wife has already left the country for Pakistan along with their children, and federal agents do not believe she has any intention of returning to the United States, according to a court document. A senior House Democratic aide confirmed that Awan was still employed by Debbie Wasserman Schultz as of Tuesday morning, but a spokesman for her later said that he was fired on Tuesday. So, wow, she does have a bar somewhere. Jim, he's now accused of attempting to defraud the Congressional Federal Credit Union by obtaining a $165,000 home equity loan for rental property, and on and on and on. The big issue here is that this guy apparently worked for a lot of different members, meaning a lot of different people's information on email and elsewhere, extremely vulnerable. And now we've got more hammers with hard drives. Apparently that's standard Democratic reaction to investigations that involve computers. What do you make of the information we're learning and the fact that most of the media doesn't seem to care?
You start looking around for the coverage of this. There's a very short space between here's what we know and what's happened. I tried to wrap up this in the morning jolt today. When you get caught attempting to flee the country, that's going to turn heads, right? Obviously, it's no longer allegations. It is now at least one charge. The fact that you've got the FBI, U.S. Capitol Police, and I believe also was Customs, all of a sudden it all seems like a lot of people for just taking some information and also taking, you know, for a fraudulent loan application to the Capital Bank. Also kind of a little bit interesting is the salaries made. But you basically some of these staffers were making anywhere from a couple thousand to a couple hundred, but working for, you know, two dozen Democratic lawmakers all at once. So a considerable amount of money. So they're all doing this on a on an effort to for $160,000 in bank fraud. Like that's that the fraudulent to get a loan that they, you know, they're transferring to Pakistan. This all seems very strange. So a lot of people go from this to he's a terrorist or he's a spy ring or something like that. It seems a little bit strange. But what's very, very clear is that, look, clearly these folks are up to no good. Clearly they were involved in accessing things they should not as part of the House's computer system. Clearly they were up to some sort of fraudulent financial activity. And the really weird – two weird things. The one was that Debbie Wasserman Schultz had this weirdly hostile exchange with the U.S. Capitol Police about getting her laptop back, which presumably had been seized as part of this investigation. And at one point during the hearing, she's basically saying there will be consequences. And oh, by the way, she's on the committee that handles the appropriations and funding for the U.S. Capitol Police. A couple of people have argued whether that constitutes obstruction of justice. I would leave that up to a prosecutor, but man, you do not usually see members of Congress going after the cops so directly and over something so personally, making her wonder, God, what's on that laptop that she's so hell-bent to get back as soon as possible? Then the next thing, of course, is that he, you know, so he got arrested Monday night. He didn't get fired till Tuesday. I mean, this guy's had this investigative cloud over his head for five months. His wife and kids run back to Pakistan. Other members of his family are also under investigation. Like this really, really looks weird because, you know, you, most of the time, the moment you're under investigation, a member of Congress will drop you like a hot potato. But for some reason, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who, let's face it, perhaps not the sharpest knife in the drawer, perhaps not always demonstrating judgment that you and I would find sane, but for some reason, she showed amazing loyalty to this fellow. While he was being accused of these crimes and not even letting him go, presumably he no longer had access to various computers in her office, which then raises the question, what exactly was he doing in the office if your IT guy can't touch a computer? Anyway, very mysterious, very weird, finally getting some more attention from the mainstream media. And I think this is worth some genuine attention. That this there are too many weird threads here to believe this is just about trying to get a loan of $160,000 that he doesn't deserve. Feels like there has to be something more for all of these various threads to be extending in these directions.
Must be that how we're going to shaft Bernie spreadsheet she had on there.
I mean, who would have figured the DNC would be like the second worst thing she would do in any given time period?
Wow. So there's a FBI investigation into this. And we're hearing today that Jeff Sessions is going to green light an investigation into all the leaks that's been happening. So if, in fact, that happens, that could get interesting. Of course, now that Trump's been barking for the past couple of weeks, we'll never really know if this was something Sessions wanted to do or Trump is pushing him into doing it. So exciting times. Jim, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.